I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News Brendan Kelly. Hello, Brendan.
Good morning, Michael. How are you?
Really well, and all the better for having just finished reading your latest book about to be published, Gerry Hart, Sex and Drugs and Not Rock and Roll, but Gilbert and Sullivan.
Yes.
Perhaps in the day, Gilbert and Sullivan was synonymous with rock and roll. Congratulations on the new book, Brendan.
Thank you very kindly, and I do like the title myself because I guess you can say that sex and drugs and music are synonymous with the human condition.
Well, I'll just introduce you slightly more formally, with a little more detail to our listeners of this podcast. This is about the author, and I'm reading from the book itself. Brendan Kelly is a Western Australian author and historian. He has a passion for B-side history, taking an off-centre approach to examining the lesser-known past. He is a regular contributor of essays to history, newsletters, and e-bulletins, typically on his special interest in amateur entertainment in Western Australia between 1875 and 1895. This is Brendan's third book, previously having written Bogan's Booze and Bad Tattoos, good alliteration there, a candid memoir of his 12 years serving as a Bunbury City councillor,
That's correct.
and The Goal Umpire, a volume of short fiction using Australian rules football as a metaphor. Brendan is a retired public servant who writes every day. He described himself as a devoted scribbler, and he explores many diverse genres in writing. Well, Brendan, it was nice of you to stop scribbling to take time to talk to me about the book. I think it's going to be officially launched this Friday night.
That's correct. Friday night at History West, which is the new name of the Royal Western Australian Historical Society in Stirling Highway. I'm looking forward to it, Michael. I think the best or the easy bit's writing a book, if I can say that. The hard bit is then the follow-up.
I have to say, a little message to the history group that I don't like the change of name, but
Okay.
leaving that aside, how did you, in your workaday life before you retired, get into all of this history stuff, particularly the local history?
Well, I've always had an interest in history, and I started off, like most people, with family history. And once I'd investigated where I came from, who I was, who others were, I guess I continued on looking at the times rather than just my family, but the times that they were living in. And with B-side stories, you, like most of us, will know that the flip side of a record is the B-side. And it's often the B-side that is the interesting part of the record. And just for listeners' knowledge, Hound Dog by Elvis Presley was a B-side. And believe it or not, the A-side was Don't Be Cruel. So when you flip the record over and looked at the other side of history, you found all of these little odd corners. And it's these odd corners that attracted me, the B side of Western Australian history, particularly as a Western Australian. I then uncovered an era, 1880s, 1890s, and I was actually particularly looking for scandal, believe it or not. And I found a character called Gerald Rakes, who was charged with indecent dealings in 1894. And I thought, there's a good scandal story. By the way, he was never convicted. He was never tried. He left the colony. However, during my investigation or my inquiry about Rakes, I kept coming up with this name, Gerry Hart or Francis Hart. And as you are as an historian, I dived down into that bunny hole. And the book is the result.
Well, it's fabulous period of history, and I take your point about the B side. I mean, for our younger listeners, they probably aren't familiar with 45 RPM records that are about 9 inches across, which have A side and the B side. Some good Beatles songs on the B side too, Brendan.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, they had double sides at one stage. I think Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields was a double A side, wasn't it? Anyway, we
Well,
digress.
we digress. And as we enter into this discussion, it's also worth reminding ourselves and our listeners that European British settlement of Fremantle, where we are, Western Australia, occurred as of 1829, about this time of the year in May, June of 1829. So if you just add 50 years to that and you suddenly turn up 1879 or another 10 years, 1889, you're not all that long into the Western Australian colony. Now, by
Correct.
1889, they were starting to find gold around Western Australia. They already found it in the 1850s in Victoria, some in New South Wales, but Coolgardie and Kalgoorlie suddenly come on stream. Huge numbers of people start turning up here, and it starts to become a time of money. The gold rush buildings are famous in the West End of Fremantle. People think that's Fremantle, but they weren't built until into the 1890s and the turn of the 20th century. But you come across this young Francis Hart. And you've told us just how you got to him. What did you discover about him? When did he get here? How old was he? What was his background?
Well, certainly when he arrived in Western Australia in September 1878, he came to work as third master at the Perth Boys' School, the government school. And it was there that he found himself, I think, behind a line of other people who were school teachers ahead of him. He was the third master. So he was clearly quite ambitious. And at one stage there, he applied for the principal's job at the Perth Boys' School and didn't get it for probably obvious reasons. And he
How old
came down to Bunbury,
are you? How did he?
where I live, ostensibly to work as the principal of the Bunbury Boys' School. I think the Bunbury Boys' School at the time was struggling to establish itself and it failed. But in the meantime, young Jerry Hart got involved in racehorses. He was the secretary of the Wellington Turf Club. And I think it was then that he became exposed to the newspapers, the bookies, the jockeys, the owners, the class of people that were living in this perhaps a faster lane, if you like to call it. And then he returned to Perth and began scratching, I suppose, or no pun, began scribbling for the Fremantle Herald. And this is around 1881.
So, what age do we think he was? Do we have a clear birth date?
I think he was born in 1879. I'm quite convinced he was born in 1859, not 79. He came here in 78. So he was 19 years of age. I believe he turned 21 when he was in this colony in the early times, probably
And
1880.
exactly where did he come from? Do we know?
He came from London, and there has been some subtle, I suppose, what you might call doubt about his parentage, his date of birth, his education in London. But I am convinced beyond any doubt that his father was the great medical journalist, Dr. Ernest Abraham Hart. And I've tracked it down.
And his father turns out to have been the editor of the famous Lancet medical journal.
Yeah, British Medical Journal. And a very famous man with a very famous second wife, not Francis's mother. Very
Who was the first wife, apparently the mother of the guy we'll call Jerry?
Yep, I believe Jerry's mother was a woman by the name of Rosetta Levi, who married Francis Hart's father, that's Ernest Hart, in June 1859. I believe Francis was born after that date, but I don't, I think Rosetta was with child when they were married.
Now, I take from anything I've read that that his father and Rosetta, his mother, were Jewish people in London.
Correct.
And who was the second wife then for Dr. Hart?
Her name was Roland, surname was Roland. Her first name just escapes me for the moment. She was herself a social reformer. from a family of social reformers, if you like. I haven't to any real extent gone down that track, but what I do know is that Dr. Ernest Hart and his wa second wife were extremely well known in London and social reformers in terms of public health in the poorhouses, bettering the lives of the poorer people. And they were quite, if you like, famous in those circles.
Do we know
Yeah.
anything about young Francis, or Jerry, as he liked to be called later, I think, education?
There's a brilliant story in the Table Talk, Victorian magazine Table Talk in 1894, which gives a great CV of Jerry Hart. I believe he wrote it himself, at least ghosted it, because it describes his life going to Ipswich School in Suffolk, how he learned Greek and French, how he was stage struck by going to local shows after he'd been injured in a football game. I'm not sure if he ever played football. He was only a little fella, diminutive, 5 foot 4, 5 foot 5, and not a sportsman, if you like to put it that way. However, he's concocted this story in Table Talk, which I've put as an appendix in the book because I believe it is Jerry Hart's invention of himself.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, people came to Australia in those days for all sorts of reasons, usually to, better themselves financially, sometimes to escape scandals or get away from their families, whatever the reasons might have been. But he finds himself in Western Australia. I mean, a lot of people were going to Melbourne, Sydney, even Hobart in those days. But he comes as a school teacher. As you say, soon enough he seems to give up that. He's only 19 or 20, in his early 20s, and then he starts taking to journalism. And if he's confident, as he seems to be, and is educated and likes to write, and it appears has this love of the arts, more generally speaking, what is his journalistic career here?
Well, he came under the wing of the great Fremantle journalist James Pearce in the early 1880s. James Pearce was with the Fremantle Herald back in those early days, a great editor, an ex-convict, by the way. And whether or not that had any influence on young Hart, I don't know. But certainly, Jerry Hart was highly educated. I've read tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of words written by him in columns, in articles, poetry, short stories, opinion. And there's no doubt whatsoever that he came from London into Western Australia as a highly educated young man. I believe he came under the influence of Pearce in the journalist world as a place of excitement where one had to find a story, talk to many people, and then there was a deadline. I think there was an exhilaration in being a journalist in those days, and that suited Jerry's personality.
It's interesting, and again, we need to remind ourselves that back in those days, through the latter parts, in fact, from the earliest parts of the Swan River Colony settlement, you not only had Perth and Fremantle, get people moving out into nearby agricultural areas like York, but you also have Geraldton,
Yes.
Champion Bay area, opening up big time. People are eventually discovering gold and other minerals up that way. And Bunbury, of course, is like an alternative port. Ships coming to Fremantle very often berthed at Bunbury and then found their way up to Freo before going to other places. So you've got these other areas of what you might call economic activity. And we know, don't we, that Hart finds himself in Geraldton. How did that happen?
Well, Victorian Express was the Midwest newspaper. Jerry was very ambitious, and I believe that the position of editor that became available on the Victorian Express at the time was something that he couldn't resist. He was still only a young man at 1883, so he's 24 years of age, and he's secured a position as editor of the Victorian Express, and off he's gone. We also must realise that the Midwest then, Champion Bay, which is now Geraldton, Champion Bay still exists, Geraldton is the town, was the port for a hinterland that was pastoral. You had the Burgess family up there, you had the Browns, who were pushing out into Aboriginal land, taking it over. And the Midwest as a port in and out also had the lead mines run by Captain Samuel Mitchell. And there was economic activity in Geraldton at the time that demanded a newspaper. And what better man? Well, I'm not sure if he was the better man, but he got the job as the editor, and he certainly stirred up the Midwest.
Well, I don't want to completely jump to the end of the book, Brendan, but in your epilogue, just before you end, you have a sentence, two sentences, which are worth reading just to try and add to the flavour of all of this. Gerry Hart lived a fast life in Western Australia. In full view, a squirt of a man with a huge ego, stage presence, alluring wit, and a lacerating pen. However, his career is dotted by caddish and deceitful behaviour. So he does sound like a guy on the make from everything you've just been saying, and you suddenly add this in, which we have to fill the dots in between now and the end of the book. But he must have had a huge ego. There's nothing he thought he couldn't achieve, and he loved to express his opinions in his columns.
Absolutely. And he was a little bloke. He was only, 5 foot 4, 5 foot 5 or thereabouts. But inside that diminutive stature, he had this huge ego and a sense of self-glory. And he wasn't shy about it. He considered himself to be a player. Indeed, he stood for politics a couple of times, or local government, and then also state government. But he was a bit of a pretender. It was a story that Gerry liked to make a story, participate in the story, and then when the story had run its race, find a new one. So by putting his hand up for various things, he was centre stage.
Well, he's a good journalist in that sense. They follow the story as long as it lives, which sometimes isn't long. But he did win the heart of a lady, Lillian. Tell us about her.
Lillian Mitchell. As an author, Michael, I think I sort of half in love with Lillian. Here was the second daughter of Samuel Mitchell, Captain Samuel Mitchell, who was captain of the Northampton lead mines. Sam Mitchell was a progressive fellow. He ended up having two wives and roughly around 19 kids, children. It's a little bit doubtful. One of his grandchildren, by the way, was the Premier, Sir David Brand. So there is a long connection from the Mitchells into Western Australian more modern history. But Lillian was a robust and very capable girl. Reports of her activities in the Midwest, mainly through the Victorian Express, mainly written by Gerry, portray this girl who could ride a horse, who could sew a frock, who could play a piano, who could dance, who could sing. She could do anything. And I've seen a photograph of her, and she actually looks chin up into the camera. Here I am. So this was no shrinking violet.
Well, two no shrinking violets, and they get together. Not everybody, it seems, thought this was a match that should be permitted.
No, A.J. Hillman, well-known character and a banker at the time, who was up in Geraldton on a banking mission for Western Australia. And he's written in his diary, which I've seen, the copy, he calls Hart an unprincipled young beggar, and that Miss Mitchell, this is Lillian Mitchell, is throwing herself away. Which is a pretty strong sort of statement.
Well, there's plenty of people who've said that about the would-be grooms over the years, Brendan. Neither you nor I, I'm sure. But What, how did you make a living out of all of this, though? I mean, you think of journalists as being pretty poorly paid at the best of the times, and if you're writing scurrilous stuff in a newspaper, I mean, who's reading it, and how does he get paid?
That's the great question, Michael. I go back, and I don't want to bore people with the Elementary Education Act of 1871, which made schooling compulsory for those between the ages of 6 years and 14 years.
This is here in WA.
Yes, what happened there is that we suddenly came a literate colony. People who previously couldn't read or write well, or not at all, became literate. Newspapers then proliferated, and this was a great era of newspaper literature. It's a brilliant time where newspapers were popping up all over the landscape. Now, the secret to making a quid, of course, money, was advertising. So, Gerry Hart, as an editor of a newspaper, was not only the editor, he was a journalist and he was the salesman, selling advertising or creating advertising in his newspapers. Now, for people to buy those newspapers, there had to be a story that could be read. And the newly literate were offered, I suppose, a story about the upper classes or the governing classes that Hart, if you like, took the mickey out of them. And of course, people would read the newspapers and they're reading about the governors and their wives and others and thinking, ha ha ha, they're not so good after all. At the same time, they're reading about a place that will sell them the latest boots or perfume, or in this case, in the drugs, the Victorian pharmaceuticals that were on sale at most of the corner stores.
Probably laudanum as well.
Absolutely. And a thing called chlorodyne, which,
Ah,
by the
didn't forget chlorodyne.
way, chlorodyne was a mix of opium, cannabis, alcohol, ether, with a little bit of sugar for tasting, but it was a pick me up and a put me down.
And you could overdose unsatisfactorily on it.
Easily.
Well, in the midst of all of this, Francis, I think, like some people do, almost a nickname, like to be more colloquial, Jerry, a friend of the proletariat, no doubt, he gets into theatre. How does that happen?
Well, his biography, written by himself in Table Talk, it's his self-admission that he was stage struck. And I think he was just a natural at it. He could play the piano, he could sing, he could dance, and he could act. And I think, as with any thespian, once you've got the attraction of the applause of the audience, it's quite addictive, probably a bit like the chlorodyne and the laudanum of the day as well. Very addictive activity. And he was very, very good at it. He could write, he was a librettist, so he wrote the words to others' music, including Governor Robinson. And he wrote a light opera at one stage. So I think he was just a person with an ego who loved an audience and he loved applause. He loved to be the center of the room. And theatre was where it was at.
Did he have any competition in that sort of world?
There were other troupes, if you like, in Western Australia. And I'll make a point here. Up until the gold rushes, amateur entertainment was the staple for people in Perth. They were isolated. Professional touring troupes may have gone to Sydney or Melbourne, but they didn't come to Perth or rarely came to Perth. It was only after the gold rushes. So up until about 1893, 94, probably even 95, after the Kalgoorlie fields had been found, amateur entertainment was how you got your entertainment. There was no radio, television, certainly no internet, that type of thing. And amateur entertainment was also in the parlour. A lot of people had pianos, and to sing around the piano was where you got your entertainment at night. And that extended to halls, Perth Town Hall and St George's Hall, which was created especially for the amateur entertainers. It was built for them.
Really important things were all of this sort of community building. I mean, many people know the story of Bishop Salvato, who famously held a concert and sang and played pianos and so on. I think again in Government House, raising funds for New Norcy when it was. There's a lot of literature from this, yes, latter part of the 19th century, which really is interesting to see if you're interested to know just how Perth worked. So how does he become friendly, if they became friends with the governor, William Robertson?
Fascinating story. It goes back to 1881 when Robinson and Hart actually began writing together. Robinson was a governor with a great gift for music, and Hart was his librettist. And in 1881, they wrote a very patriotic song called Unfurl the Flag, which was a jingoistic anthem, if you like. How Hart actually met Robinson is still a bit of a mystery to me, but they were great pals from 1881.
There must have been quite an age disparity there.
Yes, indeed. It was over 20 years. I think Robinson at the time would have been 25 years older. So, he 45, Hart, well, 45, 46, Hart 20, 21, thereabouts. But the Harts, or Jerry, knew Bill Robinson, Governor William Robinson, often referred to by Dry Blower Murphy as Fiddler Bill, by the way.
Tell our listeners about Dry Blower.
Dry Blower was another great journalist from that magnificent era of Australian newspaper literature. He came to Western Australia in 1894, following the gold, made himself a dollar or two, by the way. And then he began writing for the newspapers up in the goldfields, eventually settled into the Sunday Times, where he was a columnist and a very amusing columnist and storyteller for over or close to 30 years.
Journalists, Brendan, often on a Friday night, or depending on how busy they are, each night of the week, love catching up with other journalists, bending their elbows and yarning over a drink. Did Dry Blower and Jerry get on?
No, not necessarily. Dry Blower, like any journalist, liked to have a crack at his fellow journalists who he thought were perhaps not lesser men, but perhaps up themselves. I will tell one thing about Dry Blower was born in Victoria. He was an Irishman. He was a big fella. He was a red-headed man, robust and a big drinker. He was out there. Jerry, of course, was a little fella. He was still out there, but he's only more of an aesthetic type of character. Dry Blower loved to dig at Jerry Hart because he thought Jerry was up himself. And Dry Blower, being a robust Irishman, whereas Hart was an English Jewish man, there was they were poles apart. But Dry Blower and Jerry didn't necessarily get on. However, I will say that after Jerry had disappeared from the scene, Dry Blower described him as a clever journalist and jingler.
Well, they both knew what they were really doing, and that is selling newspapers.
Correct. And of course, I emphasize again, it was the great literature of the time. Michael, there were no public libraries. If you had a library, you were a rich man.
There was no social media to go in on and say nasty things about people, so you did it in columns in newspapers.
And did it extremely well, and becoming the most hated man in the community for a time.
Well, we start to get the picture of this guy. He presses on regardless. Did he ever run foul of the law or anything like that?
Early on in the piece, as a young man, and we're talking 1881, 1882, he was actually charged with dodgy checks. He claimed that the checks were post-dated and that they shouldn't have been presented until funds were available to be cleared. He actually got off both those charges. And the judge of the day, the magistrate, warned him that he'd come perilously close to serious trouble. Later on, he seemed to flaunt things a little. I mean, back in 1895, well after this incident of being passing dodgy checks or trying to, false pretenses, if you like. He was actually busted for riding a train without an appropriate ticket. And it was, probably the argument that he had with the conductor that prompted the conductor to say, no, I'm not going to take this. I'm going to actually charge you. And he was charged with riding a train without a ticket that was valid in 1895. And I think it was a bit of an attitude thing. I'm pretty sure Jerry Hart was a man who would who would have you on, if you like. He was very glib-tongued.
Well, he loved it when people hopped into his, as you put it, jingoistic, patriotic lyrics for the Unfurl the Flag performance. Because people suddenly wrote here and there, you don't unfurl a flag, you unfurl a sail. And he responded rather testily to all of that. He wasn't going to be taken down.
Famous argument that yes, you do unfurl a flag. I won't go into the explanation now, but the argument in the newspaper from letters to the editor who were arguing that you don't unfurl a flag, you unfurl regimental colours, was quite long, and in the end it fizzled out. But the use of words, this comes back to Jerry's education, where he believed that he knew what words were about, how they should work, and be damned anybody who would tell him how he should write.
Well, I can tell you, as the editor of Fremantle Shipping News, I'm on Jerry's side on that point, at least. Using words imaginatively, slightly poetically, and quirkily, I think nothing wrong with that at all. In fact, I think unfurling the flag sounds fabulous. And readers can find a full discussion of that in chapter five of your book, Jerry Hart. There's lots of interesting steps that you take as you go through the chapters, and there's one headed a Jewish Freemason. What's that all about?
Well, one of the things that Jerry did to inveigle his way into society was he was a joiner and he was also an organizer. So he was a Freemason. He joined the Freemasons in Fremantle, he joined the Freemasons in Geraldton, and he joined the Freemasons in Perth. And I believe that he did that because he knew that to be part of a society, you had to be in society. And part of the club or part of the church, or in this case, part of the Freemasons. He was very good at joining things, and he was a first-class secretary and treasurer, which helped him to write the minutes. And as you know, Michael, the man or the woman who writes the minutes has the power.
Well, totally. So he works out the right things to do to become part of the colonial society, the Perth-based society. How long are he and Lillian up in Geraldton for? Because they get caught up in music and things there as well, don't they?
Yes. Well, Jerry went to Geraldton in 1883 to edit the Victorian Express, and he met Lillian almost immediately. She was a prize catch, if I can put it that way. I mean, that's probably not quite politically correct these days, but in those days, she was probably the most eligible young woman in that district. And Jerry made a beeline for her. They married, they had a child in 1886. 1886, yes, married in 1885, child in 1886, and they left Geraldton in 1888. But in the meantime, they had formed the Geraldton Music Union, Musical Union. And this is where Jerry really hit his straps as a musician, as a person who was highly able in the musical world. There's a chapter in the book about his music. He actually delivered a lecture about modern music, and he did so with instruments and singers on the stage as he walked them through modern music, and his audience, that is.
While still doing the Victorian Express in Geraldton, he I think you explained in about this time of the year in 1886, 140 years ago, Brendan, he created a new column for himself called Whiffs, WHIFFS, from the smoking room by Bohemian. And he has a number of characters who chat about the issues of the day. He has Gary and Patience, the lieutenant, Jocosus, I think we say, Bohemian himself, and Saviculus, although I think he comes with his own column later. But what's going on there? Because I found that part of the book, recounting what he was doing, how he was writing, and the topics they talked about, to be really, really interesting.
Yes, going back a step, back in Victorian times, men had their smoking room. And this was a place of men only where they would have cigars, pipes, cigarettes, drink brandy, whiskey, or whatever was their favourite tipple. Hart created a smoking room in the column in the Victorian Express. And you're quite right, he would be able to talk about all of the issues of the day as if he was an eavesdropper on the smoking room. So if anybody accused Hart of having a radical idea, oh no, they're fictional characters in a smoking room. Now, I believe when they talk about aromatic cigars in the smoking room, I'm not quite sure what they were talking about, but I've got a feeling it might have been some exotic substance.
Well, maybe just Cuban.
Yeah, these were very young men too, by the way, Michael. At this stage of the game, Hart is only 25, 26, 27 years of age. And his mates, Jocosus and Patience, they were also young men. So we're not talking about, 40s and 50s, the old blokes. They're talking about, young men in their 20s who are thoroughly modern men. And of course, back in those days, the age of majority was 21, and a man became a man at 21, so he was entitled to speak of any issues. So Hart used whiffs from the smoking room as a blind, if you like, for his own opinions and the opinions of his mates.
Well, he comes back to Perth with Lillian. They have a child whose name's Geraldine, named after the mine that her Geraldine's grandfather ran at Northampton, I think. So
Yes.
they come back to Perth, and Lillian engages in the arts. She's still tied up with things. She, in fact, starts writing columns here back in Perth. But how does the relationship develop between the two of them? Was it made in heaven?
Well, I think they were a power couple, and both of them highly able. Lillian Mitchell, who became Lillian Hart, first began writing columns for the Victorian Express, the ladies' page. She went to Fremantle, where Francis was, or Jerry was, editing the West Australian Bulletin, and became Dorothy. And after Dorothy, she went to the Western Mail after the Bulletin had closed down, went bankrupt indeed, another time for Jerry. He went bankrupt several times. She began writing as Cora, Cora, in the Western Mail, and her glory years between 1891 and 1895, writing as Cora, place her as the first female influencer blogger, if you like, in Western Australia. And I admire her hugely for this. She was the arbiter of all fashion. She commented on any number of issues, women's issues particularly, and also social issues in Western Australia. So Jerry, after his journalist career, went off into business where he set up the West Australian Press Agency. Again, he was always selling something, advertising influence. And in 1891, he actually wrote the Handbook of Western Australia under the patronage of John Forrest. And I'm not quite sure if it went out to tender, Michael. I think it was chosen, and it was Jerry's style to become an expert. And as an expert, he was sought after for an opinion, and that opinion usually came with a bit of a cost, a ka-ching at the end of it.
Well, let's proceed taking into account time, but also leaving something for the readers to read for themselves when they get into the book. So you mentioned a lot of very interesting people, and they sort of come into contact with Lillian and Jerry. There's Nellie Wigglesworth, there's Mae Gibbs, there's George Anderson, there's the whole question of the Fair Maid of Perth, whether it happened or it didn't happen, and a whole lot of other topics. But I mentioned much earlier in this discussion how gold came to Western Australia, and suddenly the gold rush era hit Fremantle towards the end of the 90s. And I've been wondering whether Jerry, even though he was, working hard and making money, he was always on the lookout for the next best thing. And I'm guessing with all of these companies, the Claude Dubonalis of the world have arrived in Western Australia. Mining companies are being launched on the stock exchange in London, and no doubt amongst them all, some of them probably hadn't done their due diligence. But I'm thinking that Jerry probably thinks, if they can do it, I can do it, and I need to get rich a bit quicker than I'm getting rich.
Yes, well, from the gold rushes, Western Australia was awash with money and people coming in, Michael, and a lot of them were adventurers, people on the make and on the take. And I think Jerry had an inherent dishonest streak in him that it didn't really matter whether or not there was gold there in any particular company that he was touting. The idea was to make some money and move on. And the story of the gold rushes, the great gold boom in Western Australia in the 1890s is littered with stories of fortune, misfortune, honest people, and crooks. And I guess, if we wanted to relate it to the 80s in Western Australia, where we were living in the boom town, Boomtown 1980s in Western Australia, I don't think had much on Boomtime Western Australia in the 1890s.
Well, Western Australia always had a reputation for boom or bust, but you've got a chapter 35, which is sort of a must read because it's sort of the denouement of the life and times of Jerry. It's headed Scam at North Dandalup. What happened?
Famous story. North Dandalup, just south of Perth here in the Darling Ranges. For many, many years, they had been looking for gold in the Darling Ranges. Jerry Hart wrote a story about a gold mine being, or gold being found at North Dandalup in a shaft. And in boy's own style, he wrote it up. He shimmied into the mine and with his lamp, he could see great lots of gold. It was right before them. His compatriot, if you like, was Menzies, after whom Menzies, the town, is named. Menzies was a gold prospector. It's my view that Menzies brought the gold down from Menzies, stuck it in the hole. Jerry Hart enters the shaft or the mine, sees the gold, and he's written it up in style that you wouldn't believe. This is the next big thing. As it turned out, they crushed a lot of quartz for nothing because there was no gold, and it was a rush of extraordinary proportions for nothing. It was a scam, an out and out scam. Whether or not Jerry himself had been conned by Menzies, or whether or not Jerry was part of the con, well, all these years later, I guess we can't say we weren't there. My view is that Jerry absolutely knew what was going on, but he wrote in the newspapers how this fabulous new find would be the next best thing or the next biggest thing. He made a quid out of it too. He sold a bit of gold scriptor for ground around it.
Well, it sort of doesn't bode well. It ties in with all the other problems he'd had, the dodgy checks included. The question is, what effect did this have on Lillian's and Jerry's marriage?
I think there was huge pressure. I think eventually Lillian, being from a pretty honest family, And also her sister, she was nursing her sister, Ellen Bird, who eventually passed away from tuberculosis. I think Lillian virtually started to look at Jerry as just being a partner that she didn't need. And he was running around making deals. He was continuously spending money. I believe he kept getting into debt. There were people who were creditors who were putting pressure on her. I think in the end, she just thought, nah, this guy, I'm going to set him adrift. Although that didn't happen immediately.
So what, when did it happen, and who left town first?
Well, Jerry deserted Lillian in 1896 and went to London, where he set himself up as the knowledge, the font of all knowledge about West Australian goldfields. It didn't take long for the London Stock Exchange and those in London to find out that this guy was just a crook. And he went bankrupt eventually there. And getting back to Dryblower was gleeful in his description of Jerry going bad, going bust, as Dryblower said.
On his case. And what happened? What happened to the marriage?
Lillian eventually went back to London, or went to London, not back to London, or she went back to the UK. She was born there, but she had family in the UK, and I believe she went back there perhaps to try and reconcile with Jerry, but I believe more likely that she went there because there was nothing left for her in Perth, although she did have family there. She lived with Jerry again, according to her divorce deposition. Jerry was a philanderer by this time. He had girlfriends. He was out on the make. He was accumulating debt, scamming people. And in the end, the people who were basically aggrieved at Jerry were turning up on her doorstep, trying to get money from her, because Jerry was using her address as his office address. And the last straw came in 1904, where Jerry turned up at her house with a couple of bottles of chlorodyne, obviously fonged off his brain, making a huge performance outside her house. And within a couple of days, she'd gone and seen her lawyer to get a divorce. She cut him loose, and the divorce occurred in 1905.
Well, she certainly got on the job. The divorce petition signed by her says that he came around on the 13th of September 1904 and made a fool of himself and embarrassed her. And she signed her and signed her petition on the 23rd of September. So she got onto the job. Well, it's a fascinating period of history, and you really took me into a range of people. It requires a closer reading than the abbreviated account we're able to give here today. So congratulations on bringing it to our attention. It's good stuff. The B side of WA's colonial history. Brendan, how do people get hold of your book?
It is available at the Royal West Australian Historical Society bookshop at 109 Stirling Highway. There's a plug for you, Michael. They have copies there. It's also available at Collins Bookshop in Bunbury, or I have details. I'm not quite sure whether or not I share details on this podcast,
If you're
but
happy to, tell them where to write and get it and how much it costs.
my email number is B for Brendan, T for Thomas, KE. LLY55@gmail.com. The book is $30. If it's posted, it will cost you another $8.50. Postage hasn't gone down. If it's in Bunbury, I deliver. If I'm in Perth, I'll also deliver, because I do come up from Perth from time to time. But btkelly55@gmail.com. Please do email me, and we can establish a connection. It's a great period of history, Michael, and I thank you for bringing it to attention of your listeners.
Well, this has been fun, and I'm yes, so many interesting things to it. Do we have any idea what happened to Hart? Did he died, obviously. Do we know when and where?
Still a bit of a mystery. I suspect that he died in 1929 because in 1929 he was still being referred to as living. In 1930, there's an article in the paper that refers to him as the late Jerry Hart. So I suspect he died in 2930. I know that he went to Ghana, to the west coast of Africa, because guess what? He wrote a handbook on Ghana or on the Gold Coast, which was his modus operandi. Create a little book to tell somebody how wonderful it is. He's the expert. People consult the expert, and he takes their cash. So he's referred to as going to Spain at one stage and then to the United States. So there are little references to him well after he'd left Western Australia, but by 1930, he is definitely the late Jerry Hart.
Well, there's no doubt a little bit of final digging to be done for historians, but that always makes life interesting, Brendan.
It does.
Thanks very much for joining me today. And again, congratulations on Jerry Hart, sex and drugs and Gilbert and Sullivan.
Thank you, Michael.